Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Bob Mueller. Bob was the second longest, I believe, director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation for the United States, an old friend of mine, a person who's gone through fascinating times, interesting times in the Chinese phrase, that is, the best of times and the worst of times. Bob Mueller, director of the FBI, With Respect. Bob, how are you this morning?
Good morning, John. Doing just fine.
Good, good. Well, we've already gone over the fact that your weather is better than ours, so we're going to go from there. Bob, where are you from originally?
Well, I was actually born in New York and then grew up in New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
Oh, were you an Army brat? Did you move all around the place?
No, my father was a salesman, and he moved as a result of that, but nothing attended to the military service.
How about your mom? What did she do?
She was basically a mother. I had four siblings, making five of us, which kept her very active, very busy.
I can imagine, especially knowing you. So what were they, brothers, sisters?
Four sisters.
Oh, my God. You were spoiled, weren't you?
That's what they say, but don't believe it.
All right, what are they doing these days?
It was a challenge. Well, they're all married, have kids, and doing various occupations. One is in teaching. Another one is back in college, actually. And they've got doing all sorts of different things.
So, Bob, what happened? Where did you start your educational foundation? Where'd you go to school?
Well, I went to schools in New Jersey or in Pennsylvania growing up, and then went to prep school up in New Hampshire, then ended up going to Princeton, and thereafter somewhat later to, after Princeton, I went to NYU and got a master's degree, and then after that ended up going to University of Virginia for a law degree.
Well, that's short circuits. And when you were a kid, what was the interest in your life? What did you do? Sports?
Sports.
Sports. What
sports.
Kind of sport? What did you do?
Sports, sports, sports. hockey, soccer, lacrosse.
Oh, you had to have a stick in your hand. I can see this. You love to have a stick in your hand to beat people, right?
No, we'd use it deftly to score goals.
Ah, I see. Okay.
There you go.
So, in prep school, that was up in New Hampshire, did you say?
Yes.
What was that experience? What did it do for you or to you?
Well, the two areas that are probably most that I remember most is the fact that it really taught you to write, not only read but particularly writing at a relatively young age. And then also it was an Episcopal school, so it also ingrained in you an appreciation for the religious world as well.
Mm-hmm. At some point in that process, after high school, I presume. And maybe later on, you went into the military.
Yes.
What was
after,
that?
A year ahead of me at college was a very good friend, a tremendous leader, and he graduated a year ahead of us and some of my friends. And he joined the Marine Corps and did one tour over in Vietnam, and then volunteered for a second tour and was shot by a North Vietnamese sniper and killed. And he ended up being a motivating factor for a number of us to join the Marine Corps. It was his example, and many of us thought we would try to emulate the better parts of what he had contributed to not only the college, but also the Marine Corps and to his country. And so I ended up going into the Marine Corps.
What was his name?
David Hackett.
Well, when you went in, why? Why? I mean, you know, Marines, tough life. And especially at that, in those days when there's a whole bunch of people, and back in the Vietnam days, young people like yourselves, like the group of you, going to Canada or avoiding the draft or whatever. Why'd you volunteer?
I think part of it was you've got the draft looming without a question of a doubt. You're getting out of college. But for several of us joined the Marine Corps as a result of Hackett's example. And, you know, we don't know what we're doing. we certainly... somewhat ignorant. It does seem counterintuitive in some respects, but at that age, you think you're going to live forever. And the Marine Corps was had the ideal of discipline, and as I say, it a group of brothers working together. So it was something that not only I, but a number of others in our class at college ended up going into the Marine Corps. Many of them ended up being pilots, and several of us became grunts.
All right, Grunt Mueller, where did you go for your training, and where did you go when you were after finished training?
I went through officer candidate school, and then after officer candidate school, you go into what's called basic school in the Marine Corps, which teaches you how to be an officer, and did both of those. And then ended up going to Army Ranger School and Army Jump School on a detail with the expectation of spending some time doing reconnaissance thereafter. And after I finished those schools, I ended up going to Vietnam for a year. I came back from Vietnam, did several months back in the States, and then went off to law school.
When you were in Vietnam, what were your assignments out there?
When I was first there, I had a platoon. I was a second lieutenant, platoon commander up near the DMZ, and I stayed that. I got hit at one point and went back to the back area, and then was out in the bush again. And the last couple, two or three months, I was an aide to the commanding general for the 3rd Marine Division up in right on the DMZ. And then after I finished out, I came back to headquarters, Marine Corps.
And when you say you got hit, that goes over very quickly. You were wounded?
I was shot in the leg. Nothing very serious. I was very lucky. It was through and through. And I was back in the bush in a matter of weeks.
Okay. So you left Vietnam. You came back. You were at headquarters for a while. And then you went to what? Law school?
Indeed. Went to law school. Yep.
Which was worse, being in Vietnam or being in law school?
Law school.
I agree with that. I agree with that. When I went through, it was miserable. Hated every minute of it.
Well, after spending several years in the military, coming back in this different regimen, great somehow. But yeah. I got through it, so.
Why did you go to law school? I mean, your father was a salesman. Your mom was took care of the family. What brought you to law school?
I had visions at that point in time of joining the FBI as an agent, and that was one of the tracks into the FBI. I think that was probably, recollecting, I think that was one of the primary motives.
Why the FBI?
I don't know. I always loved investigations. You know, I always loved detective stories and the like, and the FBI has always had an image of being among the best in terms of investigative agencies, not just in the United States, but also in the world.
When you went through law school and you weren't discouraged by that awful experience, You graduated, and then what?
Then I went to a law firm out in San Francisco for a period of time until I could get into the federal prosecutor's office, the United States Attorney's Office in San Francisco. And I did 3 years in private practice, and then in the late 70s, I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco and was there maybe 4 or 5 years, and then went to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston.
Well, let me go back just a second. You had 3 years in private practice, and then you went into government service. What was the difference? I've been in both now, and I could describe my experience. But what about you? How did you find the difference between the two?
Well, the public service always has rewards that private practice just cannot provide. You're focused on what's doing right for a particular investigation, a particular case. You wake up every morning, and what you are required to do in public service is do the right thing for your office, for the country, for the case that you're handling. And some people do very well in private practice, and there are aspects of private practice I enjoy and like, but it has not over a period of time given the same satisfaction as you get from public service.
All right. What kind of cases did you work when you were in San Francisco?
Actually, I did a fair amount of trial work before boards of equalization and tax cases relating to the timber industry. I did a number of smaller trials. I did about 6 months as a public defender in the public defender's office on loan from the firm doing public defender work. So it was a smattering of different things that you would get when you just start off in a law firm.
So for 3 years of that, then four years, did you say, as an assistant U.S. attorney out in San Francisco?
Yeah, it was between just about 76 to about 82, so maybe 5 or 6 years, and then back to Boston.
Why Boston?
There, a U.S. attorney by the name of Bill Weld came in and was looking for a chief of criminal. I'd been chief of criminal out in San Francisco, and there was a new U.S. attorney there who was bringing his own person in. And so my wife and I decided give it a try, came back and interviewed and talked to Weld, and he offered me the position and said, why not? So we ended up back in Boston.
What was the difference between Boston and San Francisco?
Well, interesting. That's interesting you should ask, because whenever you go to an office, you think that all the other offices are the same, and there's something like 93, 94 United States Attorney's offices. In San Francisco back then, this is late 70s, early 80s, they were pretty far ahead in terms of computerization and digitalizing information, and I thought all offices would be the same until I got back to Boston. And you realize that they were perhaps a century behind in terms of that kind of effort. And so it was an eye-opener to realize that you could have two offices in the same strata of organizational structure, and they could be so widely different.
You know, it's fascinating because you say that, because when I was county prosecutor in Berrien County, we had, by the time I left in 1981, we had our own computer system. We had a unified case reporting system from the time of arrest on through appeals. And the courts were all integrated with the prosecutor's office. And I had a computer on my desk. And I left that on a Friday afternoon. And Monday morning, I started in the U.S. Attorney's Office, where they had one Mag A, IBM Mag A, which was cards, memory cards. They had no computers. They had no emails. All communications with Washington were by teletype. And we still use, some of our secretaries still used manual, not electric, but manual typewriters.
Well, John, you've been around a long time. This must have been back in '08 or something, huh?
And it wasn't 2000-'08. No, that's right. But that was the difference between, the county prosecutor and the U.S. attorney, where the federal government mints money, and we didn't have any use for it. So it was a big battle for me, and I'm sure it sounds like for the for Boston, a big battle to get brought into the 20th century, let alone the 21st century.
Yep.
So what happened after Boston? Bill Weld, who later ran for governor and was elected governor of Massachusetts, did you go along with him?
No. I stayed in the U.S. Attorney's office until, I'm trying to think, there was another U.S. attorney who came in, and I went to private practice for a bit in a firm back in Boston, and then they talked to me about coming down and working for Dick Thornburg, which is where I met you. And I went down to work for Dick Thornburg when he became Attorney General as one of his counselors.
Well, we're going to
do that for a couple of years.
We're going to take a pause right now and come back and talk to you about the time in the Attorney General's office, because that's fascinating. Having worked in that general area, it's an interesting world. We're talking to Bob Mueller, until recently the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and now he is in private practice. We'll be talking to him about his life now later on, but we're on With Respect, and this is John Smetanka, and we'll be right back. We're now on With Respect with Bob Mueller, who is the was the director of the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington and nationwide and internationally. This is John Smetanka. Bob, when we left off, you for the first time now are going to what we call Main Justice, and that is the that big building or down in Washington on Pennsylvania Avenue where the Attorney General of the United States and the deputy and all the muggy wumps are down in the close to the center of power down there, and that and you went right into the middle of that. Where did you go?
But I never considered you a muggy wump.
Nor did anyone else. But that's
so I went. I was an assistant to Dick Thornburg on his staff for a year or so, and then there was an opening to take over the criminal division, and I took over the criminal division. At the Department of Justice.
All right, this
for a couple of years.
You know, I worked in, as a U.S. attorney in Western Michigan and later on down in D.C. for a couple of years. But I'm not sure everybody understands, what is the criminal division and how does that fit into the work of the Department of Justice?
The Department of Justice has, as I may have mentioned before, 90-plus United States attorney's offices around the country that handle the individual federal crimes generally that arise in their particular districts. Oversight of those U.S. attorney's offices in both the criminal side and the civil side is undertaken by various components of Main Justice in here in D.C. And for the criminal division, the criminal division oversaw the generally the most of the work was done overseeing the various programs, criminal programs, that are exercised by the United States attorneys around the country, ensuring that the prosecutions conform to the Department of Justice guidelines and conform to the priorities established by the Attorney General and the President. And then it will take some large cases itself, some public corruption cases that cannot be tried in or by a particular United States Attorney's Office. But generally, the role is oversight of the federal criminal process as it's exercised by the United States attorneys around the country.
Well, now, this is where you and I come into a big difference, because I think that the work of the U.S. attorneys was far more important and far more difficult than it was for those people down there in the big building on Pennsylvania Avenue.
I don't necessarily disagree with you, and I do think that one of the problems you always face is you want trial lawyers who are making the decisions, who have been in the courtroom recently and know how things will shake out. And all too often back at Main Justice, you do not have that contribution of recent experience. people can stay too long. And without a question of a doubt, the work of the department is done in the U.S. Attorney's Office by assisting United States attorneys, without a question of a doubt.
85% of the criminal prosecutions by the Department of Justice, between 85 and 88%, are handled in the U.S. Attorney's Offices. And I gave the wrong numbers. About 95% of the prosecutions by the Department of Justice are handled by the U.S. attorneys, and 80 to 85% of the civil cases are handled by the U.S. attorneys initially. But, however, you guys in the criminal division did have some major, major responsibilities during that period of time that you were there. And I want to highlight one of them, and that was the horrific bombing of the American airliner that over Lockerbie.
Pan Am 103.
Tell us about that. What happened?
Well, I think you allude, a bomb went off over Lockerbie, Scotland, on a plane that was flying from Heathrow into, I believe it was JFK, and I think 270 persons were killed. I think 8 on the ground, the balance were on the airplane. And the investigation was undertaken jointly by the Scottish authorities as well as the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. and the Department of Justice. My role was to assist to the extent possible, coordinating with U.S. Attorney Jay Stevens in D.C., who had the case, and with the Scottish authorities. And ultimately, the investigation was done jointly. It's one of the first, in my mind, certainly one of the first large investigations was done jointly by the FBI with a counterpart agency from another country. In this particular case, Scottish authorities and FBI agents conducted the joint investigation, did joint interviews, worked on it exceptionally cooperatively, and got to a point where sufficient evidence was amassed to bring charges against two individuals, McGrahi and another. And we indicted here in the United States on the same day that the Scottish authorities indicted in Scotland. Thereafter, we identified or ended up getting two of the individuals who we believe were complicit in it, and they were tried under Scottish by the Scottish authorities in Scottish courts. One was acquitted, the other convicted, McGrahi, and he was ultimately released by the Scottish authorities several years ago.
Yeah, well, let's take a minute and talk about that, because that was a very controversial thing, not only here and all, but also in the UK, the release of McGrahi. He was a Libyan, and the at least the buzz on the outside, whether or not it was true or you knew your investigation showed it, was that Muammar Gaddafi had, or part of his government, or part of his secret intelligence operation had sponsored this this bombing. And if you care to comment on that, you can at this point, but that's what was the buzz outside.
I think the trial showed that McGrahi was an intelligence agent. I think most people know and understand that things did not happen in Libya without Gaddafi's knowledge, understanding, and support.
And as a result of that, he was incarcerated, but some years later, there was a push on by some people, someplace in the UK government and the UK population and business to return him to Libya, correct?
Yes, he was suffering from cancer, and the belief was for humanitarian reasons he should be released. I am not certain. I'm certain we did not agree with that in any way, shape, or form. And those in the United States were upset and outraged that this action was taken.
And as I recall, he was supposed to be so sick that he was going to die within weeks, and it turns out he lived for some years in relative comfort in Libya.
Correct.
So sometimes in the prosecution of major or minor cases, good things happen, and sometimes the results aren't exactly what you like. How do you still deal with the frustrations? I mean, this has got to be something that is all the way through your life, that you see the You want to do good, and the people around you want to do good, and you do the best you can, and then whammo, something bad happens, or something falls apart, or there's a lack of cooperation, or a jury doesn't understand the case, or one of your supervisors doesn't understand the case, or somebody dies. Those are frustrations. And so this frustration with Lockerbie and McGaughey have got to have had some effect on your perspective on what you do.
I've always believed that I have great belief in the American system of justice. And like you, I'm sure, as a prosecutor, there are cases you have to bring. But the jury may find the evidence insufficient to convict, and you do your job, and the system does its job. Yes, it can be frustrating, but that's the system, and there is, in my mind, no better.
What other major cases did you work on as head of the criminal division, or supervised as a head of the criminal division while you were there?
Who is it? The dictator from Panama, Noriega, was one of those cases. We had a number of substantial public corruption cases. Those are the one, and white-collar criminal cases. There, at that point in time, we were going through the savings and loan crisis, and there was a backlog of savings and loan cases that we had to drive through during that the period that I was in the criminal division.
I remember
those are the big ones that I can recall.
I remember the savings and loans issue cases very, very well, because the day I walked into Bill Barr's office as his chief assistant, he was sitting on a couch, which was turns out to be in my office, and he looked at me and said, "Do you know anything about savings and loans?" And as a result, I spent the hardest 90 days of my life trying to figure out what we actually had done and what we could do for the investigation and prosecution of major SNL cheats. And we got Jim Richmond in to be the first SNL czar, and the rest is history. And we had actually done a very good job. It's just we didn't get any publicity for it. And it didn't get in the way of people around the around Washington and the Capitol using phony statistics to make us look like we were asleep at the switch. But at any rate, it all turned out for the best after a lot of hard work. So, Bob, after your time as head of the criminal division, that was sort of the end of the Bush administration, as I recall, and you went off into private life like the rest of us did.
I did, yes. I did another stint in private practice, maybe 18 months, 2 years, something like that.
Whereabouts?
Here in Washington, D.C., a firm called Hale & Dorr.
What got you to leave there? I mean, my recollection is you were doing very well financially and didn't have an awful lot of hard work in Hale & Dorr to earn that. I'm teasing you. But you abandoned.
I was wondering.
You abandoned that and you went back to government.
I went back to the U.S. Attorney's Office here in D.C. and tried homicides. Became head of the homicide branch for a period of time.
Why? You took a big cut in pay to go back to just try homicide cases. Why?
Because they're some of the most challenging cases. I always have loved the forensics, my DNA, fingerprints, blood splatter, the components of putting together a homicide case, the medical examiner's office, all over the years have been fascinating to me. And in terms of contributing to the system of justice, there really is no greater challenge than to bring to justice somebody who's murdered another person and try to, in some way, assuage the grief of those who lost a loved one. And there's huge satisfaction in doing those cases, although I lost some, which were frustrating when that happens. But nonetheless, some cases the evidence just wasn't there, and the jury found that the evidence wasn't there. But it was tremendously satisfying work, and it probably has been, looking back, has been one of the most rewarding, although anxious, I guess you could say, times that I spent as a prosecutor.
Well, you left that office and went out west to San Francisco again, as I recall.
They were looking for somebody as an interim United States attorney out there. The U.S. attorney they had left, and they were looking for somebody who was knowledgeable of the office to come in and ask me if I'd be willing to do it for a few months, and I said yes. And a few months became longer than a few months, and I did become the U.S. attorney out there.
Well, all right. Before we start into that route, we're going to take a break. Because this becomes another interesting chapter in your life. This is With Respect. We're going to take a break now. We're talking to Bob Mueller, the recently retired director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And this is John Smetanka. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Bob Mueller, until recently the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation of the United States Department of Justice. This is John Smetanka. Bob, when we left, we found you on a plane going out to San Francisco again. What happened out there? You became a U.S. attorney out there, and what you won't say, but I will, is that the office was not in good shape, and you were brought out there as an outsider. You're not a person from California at that point. You hadn't been there for a while, and you were called in to straighten things out. Did you?
I'd like to say I think I made some improvements. Left it somewhat better than it was before. You had good people in the office. So it was just a question of arranging things to maximize their contributions.
Well, I will interject at this point. The stories that I heard from other people inside and outside of the office about your work out there was, in fact, that you did a hell of a good job and brought some discipline and some good morale back into the office. But you were there how long?
I was there probably 2 years, 3 years, something like that.
Then what?
Then they were looking for I did a stint back as acting deputy when George Bush came in for a few months under John Ashcroft when he was attorney general. And then that was on detail from San Francisco back to Maine Justice. And I went back to San Francisco, and then Louis Free, head of the FBI, resigned. And they were looking for a head of the FBI and asked if I'd be interested. I indicated I would, and
So you finally got your desire to be an FBI agent after all those years. And in fact,
it took 30 years or so.
It took 30. So, hey, there's hope for all of us, Bob, that eventually you'll find the right woman, you'll find the right man, you'll find, you know, the right situation. Unfortunately, you weren't able to be a brick agent. You had to go up to the top floor and be the boss of the whole place.
Yeah. And that's a hindrance. If you don't know, if you haven't been there as an agent, it's hard to know and understand what really moves an organization.
Well, that's a very important thing, which we're going to talk about, because, you know, you're dealing with an organization that has a great and long history when you walked in the door. And in short circuit, I think we can talk about the fact that J. Edgar Hoover, who is not the first director of the FBI, but rather the longest serving, I think he served from 1924 to 1977. So he basically had a chance to take that agency from a little known and maybe not awfully professional outfit into something which was world renowned and world, if not respected, feared for its ability to make cases and to bring bad guys to justice and maybe do some other things. But it went through a period of time from 77, when Hoover left, he died, to the point where you came in, there was a series of short-term directors of the FBI, and then you walk in. What do you find the day that you walked in to the FBI? What kind of an organization was it? What were its priorities, and what were your plans the day you walked in?
Well, when you mentioned the interim directors, I'd point out, I think Judge Webster was director for maybe something like 8 or 9 years and did a heck of a job. Louis Free, my predecessor, did a great job in expanding the programs internationally. So a lot was done in that interim period between Hoover and when I took over. As you know, I took over a week before September 11th. On September 4th, and consequently, I have no idea that terrorism would reign supreme in terms of priorities there afterwards. And actually, being in California, you were not aware of the terrorism cases that had been handled by the FBI overseas, the embassy bombings in East Africa, the coal bombing, the towers bombings in New York. When you're out in San Francisco, you don't. That does not resonate with you, and consequently, I knew terrorism would be an issue, but did not have a much of a background in doing that type of case, other than Pan Am 103, of course.
Well,
until that time,
Bob, let me stop you and go back for a second.
Yeah.
During that period of time, from when Hoover took it over and started to mold the organization in his own image, The Bureau, Federal Bureau of Investigation, grew exponentially in terms of personnel, but it also had some very well-known areas of concern. For example, interstate crime. Back in the 20s and 30s, you had the various gangs, the bank-robbing gangs, the Bonnie and Clydes and the Dillingers and whatnot, running around. During the Second World War, Hoover made it the counter-espionage agency for the United States, it seems. And then after the war, it developed into other areas. What were those areas? What, you know, that agency, when you got in there on the, whatever is the 7th or 8th of November, of
September 4th,
yeah. What were its priorities at that point?
I think you roughly outlined the history of the Bureau in terms of its growth. Interestingly enough, there would be no Bureau without the automobile. It was the advent of the automobile and the ability of criminals to undertake bank robberies or other interstate crimes, and one agency had the jurisdiction to pursue them across state borders within the United States. And as a result of the automobile, the FBI was born, and it was born to take on those cases that were not limited to a particular locale or state, but crossed state lines. And over a period of time, in World War II, it had a counter-espionage mission. Throughout, it's always done the bank robberies and the extortions and the like. But then after that, narcotics trafficking, organized crime, I think even Hoover himself indicated that he was slow to recognize the impact of the mafia and other organized criminal groups. And by the time 2001 comes along, yes, it's focused on terrorism, both domestic. There was the Oklahoma City bombing, as well as international terrorism. I mentioned a few East African embassy bombings, coal bombings, and the like. The focus was on white-collar crime. The focus was on narcotics trafficking and the cartels. The focus was and has always been on both civil rights and public corruption, because if the Bureau does not conduct those investigations, often those investigations do not get done. But those were pretty much the priorities. Always, when you had kidnappings or extortion across state lines, the Bureau would be there. But that was sort of the menu of cases that the Bureau was addressing on prior to September 11th.
I remember also back in 1991 when the 1991-92, when the Soviet Union began to collapse, and the FBI, as did everybody else, thought, well, the Cold War is over. We're done. We're finished. Espionage is not as big a deal. Foreign espionage is not going to be as big a deal as it has been. That was part of their role, the working against spies and saboteurs in the United States. And then we back in 91-92, began to look at, and I say this we, that is the department. I was in Washington at the time, and you were in head of criminal division at the time. As I recall, the FBI came over and talked to the deputy, and to, I think you were present, about new priorities. And one of the new priorities is, which I want to touch because it seems to have gotten a new birth, a new life, and that was commercial espionage. That is, we began to look at not necessarily the spies from the Soviet Union as much, although it continued, but more at the people, the institutions, and the countries who are robbing our technology, our business secrets, and our business.
I think that's true. I don't have a memory myself of that particular meeting. I do know that from 1991-92 that you outlined to today's date, the growth in theft of intellectual property, the United States, industrial espionage conducted by other countries, principally the Chinese, quite obviously, but also to a certain extent Russia and other countries, but also middlemen who would steal the secrets and sell them to the highest bidder, has grown exponentially, and in great, principally, not necessarily principally, but by the use of cyber capabilities to conduct espionage, which were not, those abilities, capabilities were not there in the early 90s or even the late 90s. But now, because everything is digitized, the growth of theft of intellectual property by cyber means is huge now, is going to remain that way for the foreseeable future.
We're going to come back to that in more detail, but this was the world. All of these things that you've described were the beginning of the world when you walked in to the FBI's office as the director on September 4th of 2001. And one other area I did not mention, and it was domestic terrorism. We had some of that as well. We had, in Michigan, for example, we had worries about various separatist groups that wanted to bomb federal buildings and create their own states and rebel against taxes and so on. But we even had, as I recall, the FBI had a bad situation in Ruby Ridge in which there was an attack on a farm out in Utah or Idaho?
Idaho.
And that resulted in a lot of controversy, not only before you became director, but afterwards.
Well, most of the controversy predated me as a director. That had been thoroughly investigated. Issues related to that episode had been thoroughly investigated. Reports had been done, and suggestions made as to lessons learned from that particular incident. That was one of the things that I was concerned about, is how you handle incidents like that, whether it be white supremacists or other terrorist groups where you have standoffs and you have civilians caught in the middle, who you have handled the particular situation, what is the chain of command, when is the decision to be made as to whether you can use lethal force or not. Those are all issues that were one knew had to be addressed at that time, but actually the dissection of what happened and Ruby Ridge had been completed by the time I walked in there.
Well, there's one more thing. Ruby Ridge did result in a lot of controversy and eventually review of how you did things, how you do things. We also had, by the way, Waco, which happened in 2000. When was that? 1994. in which there was a standoff. The FBI did not take the lead, as I recall, in that case. It was the ATF down in Waco, Texas, with the Branch Davidians and David Koresh. But again, you've got a situation where people, dissenting people, people who have alternate life goals and societal goals, come crashing up against laws or community standards or whatever, and it produces violent confrontations. Again, we've all seen the pictures of Waco and the shock that we saw of the flames of the place, the main house, going up for grabs and knowing that people were inside and were killed.
So, yes, one thing I would correct you on, the ATF was initially in it, but the Bureau was in it at the end. We were part of that. And actually, I believe it's fair to say that we took the lead after a period of time in that particular episode. So that was another instance where you had to look at it and look at it closely to determine what mistakes were made and make certain that they're not made in the future.
All right. September 4th, 2001. You walk in the door. We're going to stop you right now. We're going to take a break, and we're going to begin your experience as director and some of the wild and crazy and fascinating things that happened while you were there. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect, talking to Bob Mueller, the recently retired director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Bob Mueller, the recently retired director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and this is John Smetanka. Bob, when we broke, I just led you up to the day that you came in, as the September 4th. Shortly after that, and this is an event which did not get much national publicity, but it sure did here in Western Michigan, right nearby, on part of our listening audience. Cass County had something called the Rainbow Farm, and there was, as I recall, shortly after you got in, a confrontation there that involved, at least in part, the FBI. Do you recall that one?
I don't recall that. I did go back and take a look, and I see that confrontation did take place either the day before or the day that I was sworn in, but it did not. I do not have a recollection of being informed about it or having some say as to what would happen in terms of the resolving that situation.
Well, now, moving, 4 or 5 or 6 days later, 9/11, we come to the magic date that the world changed, and certainly the world of the FBI and the world of Bob Mueller and the world of all of us here in the United States. What happened that day? You probably told this over and over again and probably are sick of talking about it, but we would be very fascinated knowing what happened, what your perceptions were, what happened.
Well, I was being briefed that morning when the first plane went in. Agent comes in and says, "Director, there's a plane has hit one of the towers in New York." And you look outside, it's a beautiful day. You ask what the day's like up in New York, they say a beautiful day. And so you're scratching your head as to how a pilot could be so wildly off course as to strike one of the towers in New York. And at about that time, another agent comes in and says there's been another tower struck by yet another plane up there. And by that time, I think we were certainly coming to the belief that it was more than just an accident, that it probably was a terrorist attack of some ilk. And by the time the plane went into the Pentagon, I think those who have been in this business at the Bureau for a long time, I believe that not only was it a terrorist attack, but the only entity, if you can call it that, that would be capable of undertaking such an attack was bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And we go down to a command center a couple floors down by that time, and knowing that we have a great deal of work to do. And while we're in the command center, we hear over the loudspeaker a voice from the FAA indicating that a plane was inbound to Washington, D.C., had been hijacked, and was maybe 50, 80 miles out. And we're sitting there wondering what the target of this particular plane is. The FAA announcer comes back and says, hijacked airplane 50 miles out of Washington, D.C., and realize that it's getting closer. That, of course, was a plane that went down in the fields of Pennsylvania, but it was somewhat surreal to be sitting there wondering what the target was going to be. A plane goes down in Pennsylvania. We recognize it's the fourth in a series of similar attacks. And our greatest concern, quite obviously, then was, hey, is this the last? Or what other planes are there out there that could also be hijacked and run into buildings? So all planes were grounded in the United States. All planes coming into the United States were turned away until we could get a grip on the intelligence and the situation. I mean, my role was basically at that point in time to get out of the way and let the Bureau do what it does best. Bureau is just terrific in handling crises. It's got unbelievable competencies when it comes to setting up command posts and organizations around circumstances or situations such as we saw on September 11th, and the people in the Bureau did a terrific job in responding and responding quickly.
Bob, you were in there for 7 days. You had seen time in Vietnam, in combat in Vietnam. You had seen crises in domestic and foreign terrorism. And do you think that anybody, any agency, or any director can be fully prepared by whatever experience they have for such a shift, a quantum shift in the event that such as 9/11?
Well, there are always going to be events. Hopefully none so large and devastating as 9/11, but there will always be attacks. The concern, as I think we're going to discuss later, is what we're facing now in terms of smaller lethal attacks by what we would call lone wolves. So there are always going to be attacks, and you try to prepare. You try to put out tripwires so that you are tipped off to purchases of explosives, timing devices, that kind of thing, and can follow it up. But there, as I go back and keep saying, there will always be these attacks. You hope that you do the best job possible in attempting to prevent those attacks. I will tell you that one of the shifts for me was in terms of mindset. I'd always been a prosecutor, expected to follow the work of the FBI, which generally is collecting evidence for a courtroom to convict somebody of a crime that has already occurred. And I came into the position as director and assuming that that would be the major role. Sure, we do counter espionage and the like, but that would be the major role that the Bureau would continue to undertake for the future. One of the first briefings I did of President Bush, after going through what the Bureau was doing and trying to identify the hijackers and the association with bin Laden. And President Bush says, well, my question to you is, what has the Bureau done to prevent the next terrorist attack? And I was felt like an 18-year-old teenager who got the wrong assignment, as I had not focused on that. But I can tell you, after that briefing on that day and after September 11th, that became the focus of the FBI. What have we done to prevent the next terrorist attack? And we tended to shift somewhat substantially in our outlook in terms of not just in counterterrorism, but across the board is what is the threat? What do we know about the threat? What don't we know about the threat? Collect against that gap and do what we can, not only to investigate crimes after they've occurred, but prevent crimes, particularly terrorist attacks, before they do occur.
Bob, when you before you took over, and this has no ill reflection on anybody, I'm just making the statement. I remember when I was U.S. attorney and the FBI agents who would come into our office were split into two groups. There was the ones that we dealt with who were dealing with criminal investigations, and we worked with them regularly and made cases and or gave up on cases that were not able to be made. But then there was this other shadow group of people, which were called FCIs, Foreign Counterintelligence. And those guys, when they came in, and gals, when they came in, were not there to help us with anything. They were there to gather information, and it became the proverbial dark hole that information would go in but not come out again. There was this disconnect between foreign counterintelligence on the one side and criminal investigation on the other. Do you recognize that? Do you remember that from those days?
I do remember that, and I think most of what you say is probably accurate. Too little credit has been given to the persons in the Bureau prior to September 11th and the capabilities that were demonstrated in addressing terrorism before then. The Bureau had been tremendously successful in addressing the persons responsible for, as I said, the East African bombings, the coal bombings, the if you look at domestically, the Oklahoma City bombings. And they had prevented a number of attacks that had not become known. This is all prior to September 11th. What did need to happen was prioritization of the Bureau's activities to reflect the change in circumstances attributable to September 11th, and that's what we went and tried to accomplish.
Bob, the questions that you are trying to grapple with as the planes are flying in, and then as you go over to talk to President Bush afterwards and you're confronted with his question to you, these are things that all of us in who have had anything to do with law enforcement or FBI or state or local, that we all have to struggle with. We all have to figure out what are we supposed to be doing here. Are we? And we're going to be working with you on another show. And during that time, I want to focus on what can we do. What have we done to adapt ourselves to this new world? Secondly, what are the dangers that adapting to this new world? The unexplored and unanticipated consequences of this new world, how do we adapt our organizations and ourselves to this world? Because I think that as one of my associates, one of my law partners said, when she was sitting out, she had worked counterintelligence when she was in Washington working with the FBI and counterespionage, and she said, when she heard about and saw the planes crashing into the towers on 9/11, she sat there and couldn't work on the legal business that she had because, she said, the world has changed. It's never going to be the same. And she actually couldn't get that through, frankly, to some of the people who were around her, but it in fact did, whether we like it, whether the whole society likes it or not, whether the whole society was ready to have this new world. Unfortunately, the society and the world changes whether we are ready for it or not. Bob, I want to thank you very much for being on with us for this first of two segments with you, and then the next show we're going to talk about with you the future and how we can go about adjusting ourselves and our society to balance things like privacy and surveillance, things like security and freedom, and so on. So, Bob, thank you very much. We'll talk to you on our next show.
Thank you, John.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And I want to again thank our guest, the retired director of the FBI, Bob Mueller. This is John Smetanka. And remember, our mantra, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.